Welcome to Open Book. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Sharon Gless, who is starring in a production called A Round-Heeled Woman by Jane Prowse at Z Space at Theater Artoth in San Francisco through February 7th. Sharon Gless was starring in Cagney and Lacey as Christine Cagney. Queer as Folk is Debbie Novotny. Burn Notice, Nip Tuck, Independent Films, BBC miniseries The State Within. Sharon Gless grew up in Hollywood. Her grandfather was an attorney for the studios. And apparently Sharon Gless was the last contract player in the history of Hollywood with Universal, which we'll go into a little later. But let's start first by talking about your work in this play, A Round-Heeled Woman. Apparently, there was an article in the New York Times about a memoir called A Round-Heeled Woman by Jane Juska, and your husband, who's a producer, threw the New York Times down and said, if you have any balls, you'll get a hold of this play. Is that pretty much it?
Well, his exact quote is, if you had any balls, you'd go after this. And I was so angry at him that I did. I called my lawyer, and it took me a year to get it. But I initially made that call the next morning just because I was so mad at him at daring me.
Well, she, in the play, is 66. Was she actually that old in the book?
Exactly. When she took out the ad, she was 66, about to be 67.
So this is kind of serendipitous that you happen to be the same age at this point.
Well, it's so interesting. I was telling Jane Prowse, who wrote the adaptation and made it into a play. I've had this project for almost 10 years now. Could not sell it in America. It just was a little too daring. And I had to go to London to a West End producer to do it. It's been a long, long, long time. And I am now 66, about to be 67. I'm exactly the same age Jane was when this happened to her.
Had you thought about making it a film rather than a play? Or?
We thought of a film. We thought even more specifically a series, because that's really my arena. That's what I do. And couldn't sell it, not even to cable. And it's fascinating. Women my age in America, no one is interested, they say, in hearing about a woman that age and her sexual experiences. You go to London, and they have Judi Dench, Joan Plowright, Helen Mirren, Maggie Smith, Julie Walters, these amazing, very sexy women who they do, I don't mean exploit, but they do use in a very sexual way in film. The truth is, those women know a lot more about sex than the 20-year-olds. You know, they know what they're doing, and they're very sensuous. Anyway, a West End producer said, I will do it. But it's very American, Sharon. So before I put it in the West End, I want to try it out in the United States. We're taking our shot in San Francisco because we think you're a pretty cool town.
Chris Smith, the director, was with The Magic. So
yes.
I assume this was originally going to be going to The Magic, but now it's independent.
He was approached while he was at The Magic. But he was leaving The Magic. I guess after he was able to sever himself from The Magic, he then took it on for us.
Well, Sharon Gless, how is developing a character in a play different from, say, a TV series or a film?
In this particular case, I own the option on this, so I guess you'd call me a producer, in name only, because I'm with the best producers there are. In television, usually I just step into it. All the work's done. I just step in and play the role. This one, I've been much more involved. This is a lot more work. Theater's a lot more daunting to me. I mean, I'm doing my 10th series now. Someone Googled me the other day saying that I have done more TV series than anyone in the Television Academy now. So television is my home, and I know what I'm doing in that arena. This is a little frightening for me, and also because I am playing a real woman who's going to be there opening night.
When you say that you're playing a real woman, in terms of that, how much of your knowledge of Jane do you take with you into, say, creating a physical life of a character?
As I've told Jane, I don't look anything like Jane, and I don't sound anything like her. Jane and I communicate occasionally, not often. But I said, Jane, I'm not going to be mimicking you or imitating you. I'm not that good. But I will be using her words. When Jane Prowse adapted the book into a stage play, she lifted a lot of Jane Juska's words right out of the book. So I am going to be saying a lot of Jane's words, but I'll be saying them in my way.
So you kind of put her aside in that respect?
Well, only the physicality of her.
Right.
Certainly not emotionally, no. I have not put her aside emotionally at all.
The first time you walked into, say, playing Christine Cagney
right.
or Debbie Novotny, right? yeah, you're not the producer, you're just stepping into the part, but on the other hand, you have an idea of who the character is, right?
Yes. Yes, before I agree to play a role, yes, I do an inner investigation of the character or if it's something I feel I can do and do justice to. Now, as opposed to playing Jane, I feel a great responsibility to do her justice. And it's not all flattering. She's seen the script. She knows. She's heard the read-through. I mean, which is taken out of her book. But she's extraordinary. She went and did something that was very, very brave.
Well, what she did was she put an ad into the New York Review of Books, and 66 years old, I want to have sex.
I would like to have a lot of sex with a man I like.
And, of course, she wound up having a lot of sex with a lot of men that she didn't necessarily like.
The second half of her ad said, yes, if you want to talk first, Trollope works for me.
Well, then you approached Jane Prowse about writing the play, right?
My husband and I, we flew to London and met with Jane Prowse. Just gave her the book and said, Jane, are we crazy? But we knew a studio had been fighting me, you know, for this option. So somebody's interested. I said, are we crazy? And Jane said, let me read it. 6 months later, she got back to me because she'd gone on her honeymoon and gone around the world. And she wrote me, she said, Sharon, I'm so sorry. I'd got married, went around the world. I have read your book, or Jane's book. And she said, not only must it be done, she said, I must write it. I said, wow, okay. And she took it to Brian Eastman, who's a very big West End producer. I did Misery for him in the West End. And Brian said, absolutely, this is a hot one. Okay, let's go. And so I thought, well, we're going to go right into the West End, yay! And he, as I said no. Try it in America first.
When she actually presented the play to you, when was that? When did you first see the play?
Well, we've gone through so many rewrites. I'd say maybe a year later, we saw the first play, and it's been many years, and it's gone through many, many lives and many rewrites. But it's where it is now than where it's supposed to be.
The play itself uses several theatrical techniques, breaks the fourth wall, this fantasy sequence, this telescoping, this narration. I mean, it uses virtually everything, things going on in her head. In the original play, was that all evident?
Oh, yes. This is not a play just about a woman having sex. She also has to face many demons, and these are the things that come up as part of her journey. This just isn't porn. She faces the issues with her son, who she hadn't seen in 16 years. She faces the issues with her father. She's in therapy while she does it. And that's all in the play. But it's this journey that forces her, this journey she chose, to ask for sex with a lot of men. Not a lot. She said, with one. She said, with a man I like.
Right, yeah.
As she says in the play, she had never expected to be so plural. But in the end, it forced her back to her greatest pain, which was the loss of her son. They separated many years before.
How does working on a play that's in the experimental stage here in San Francisco mm-hmm. differ, say, from working on a play like Misery, which went to the West End?
There's a lot more money in the play in the West End than we have. This is what Brian Eastman calls experimental theater, not commercial theater. He was very, very clear about that. We're doing it with a lot less money and using this huge, huge space. We don't have a big fancy theater. We're using this amazing space called Z Space. It's an old deserted warehouse. It's perfect, but it's big. Well, for me, because I've been here on the ground floor for this project, in Misery, I just flew to London. They showed me the sets, rotating stages, music originally composed. There was a lot of money behind that production.
Well, on the other hand, we're also moving, I think, into a phase, from what I've seen, where a lot of shows and plays are being downsized because production costs
are so
high. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And this, I forgot to mention, this play was originally a two-hour, and it was whittled down to a 90-minute, which that has nothing to do with money. That just is appropriate for this piece.
Without
an intermission.
Yeah.
Right.
How do you feel about working without an intermission?
I love it.
Really? Why?
I really love it. Well, first of all, you know, this is a very scary project.
Right.
It takes a lot of guts. Took a lot of guts for Jane Jessica to do it, and taking a lot of guts for me to do it. When something's this daring, I'm so glad we don't give anybody a chance to get up and leave. Once they're hooked, you know, like the other night, not one person left. And I think it's appropriate for this piece. I don't get tired. Once I'm on there, I can stay for 90 minutes. I never leave the stage. The other actors, you know, come around me and play sometimes 2-3 roles. But I'm on there for 90 minutes without stopping. But when you're doing it, it seems like 10 minutes. You're into it.
When you're working it and bringing out the emotions, are you finding places in you, Sharon Gless, where you feel you've never gone before?
Yes. That's an interesting question. Because I don't have a technique. I have always sort of done this craft I do that I've been lucky enough to be welcomed into, sort of by the seat of my pants. And I do it just from here. I don't have a lot of training, but whatever it is, I've been very fortunate to have had a career that's sustained. This is a very emotional piece, and each night I'm always surprised which piece gets me. I don't plan. Oh, good, I'll cry in this part. I don't plan anything. I just sort of go with it, and I'm always surprised each evening. There's certain moments where all of a sudden I'm taken back by it. You know, it gets me. And other moments where, gee, I planned on that happening later on. Each night it's kind of a surprise for me as to where I go with it.
Well, isn't that to some degree true of all theater? I mean, no performance is ever the same, nor should it be the same.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's what they say. I've done like maybe 5 plays.
Yeah.
It's still always a new arena for me. I can't yell cut, you know, and I do know how to work with a camera, one camera. It's always new. It's always fresh. It's frightening. Listen, if I told you I wasn't petrified going out there and doing this, I would be lying to you. But it's worth it. And this story is worthy, and I'm very proud to be the one to tell it.
Sharon Gless, let's talk a little about the rest of your career. Your bio says your grandfather was an attorney in Hollywood. Did you have any connection growing up with Hollywood then?
Not directly like he did. He was a really big attorney. He was Cecil B. DeMille's attorney, Louis B. Mayer's, Howard Hughes. I've been to Mr. DeMille's house, you know. Mr. DeMille invited us all to see the Ten Commandments before it came out. But I was a little girl, you know, in my white gloves and my Mary Janes. And I met sometimes famous people through him, but just really on the periphery. He told me once when I was in high school, if I lost 25 pounds, he'd take me to lunch with Cary Grant. But I not only did I not lose the 25 pounds, but I just had this image. Well, if I lost it, he'll go to Mr. Grant and he'll say, look, this is my kid, okay? She lost all this weight so she could see you. And I was too embarrassed to go through that process. But I've heard many, many stories about Howard Hughes because my mother and her siblings knew him because my grandfather was his lawyer, so he was always hanging around the house.
Did you see the Scorsese film, The Aviator?
That was more about his airplane life. My grandfather was very involved in his Hollywood life, in his studio, in movies. There was a movie out many, many years ago called The Carpetbaggers, and it was about Howard Hughes. Well, the lawyer in that was my grandfather. It was okay. Neil McCarthy.
One of the stories I have here is that you said you went from being in a secretary's desk to being in front of a camera.
It is true. I was a secretary when they found me. It's not as a Schwab's drugstore story, but it's pretty close. I had decided very late in life, at age 26, that I wanted to be an actress. And I was at this little workshop with some other much younger people than myself. I was like in the teenage class. And one of the kids in the class had written this little play and asked outside the workshop if we want to audition to be in it. So I auditioned and I got the female lead. And it was a very campy melodrama and we didn't charge anyone. I only ran 2 nights, you know, with folding chairs at the senior center. But someone in the audience from Universal Studios was there the second night. And he called me up at my office and he said, Sharon, this is Orin Borst, and I'm in publicity at Universal Studios. I saw you in your little play, and I said, yes. I'd worked behind the camera, so I knew all the scam. I said, yes, and he said, I'd like you to meet John Cassavetes. You'd be perfect for the lead in his new film, and I want you to meet Monique James, the head of our talent department. Well, everybody knew who Monique James was. Everybody wanted a contract, and she was queen. So I said, okay, cut the bull. Who is this? And he said, I understand you're being skeptical. Why don't I have Miss James call you? I said, yes, do that. But I'd worked so many years behind the camera that I knew every game. And by God, she called me. And I went over and I met her and she asked me if I would prepare a scene for her. I did. I brought it back many months later. She finally called and said, are you ever going to bring that scene in here? And I said, well, yes, Miss James, but I was told that occasionally you remember if we're good. You never forget when we're bad. She said, just bring it in. So I said, all right. So I brought it in. She signed me that night.
And what did they immediately put you in? Anything? Or?
I read that night. They asked me to read for Ironside to play the sidekick. And he said I was really terrible, the producer, and I didn't get that job. But she said, I don't care what he says. He said, we're signing you to a 7-year contract. That's very heady stuff. I think I went home and threw up. I don't remember. It was very, very exciting. And they, so the very first thing I did for them, I think it was Marcus Welby. It was a big television, the biggest television studio in the world. And all the contract players were put in the TV shows, not in the features. The producers on the lot weren't necessarily interested in having it. They wanted to hire from outside. And they felt contract players were pushed on them. So we didn't always get jobs. We had to read for everything, just like everyone else. But if you were a contract player, you were given the sides the night before. The sides, like the script, okay, the night before, so it wasn't a cold reading for you. As I went along, they'd build a little reel of the film I was doing. And Miss James would take me into these, in those days, they had big screening rooms. You know, now screens are, you know, 3 inches. But in the days of massive screening rooms, just myself and Miss James, and there'd be a projectionist that I didn't see. And she would speak to the projectionist and say, please run Miss Glass's film. And that's how I would learn. She'd run my film for me and tell me what I was doing wrong, what I was doing right. And she gave me the greatest lesson ever, ever given to me, certainly as an actor. And she said, learn to listen. I said, I beg your pardon? She said, you're not listening there. You're waiting to say your line. I said, I know, I was frightened. And she said, learn to listen. She said, because if you really, really listen to your partner, they're going to cut to you because your face is going to become so interesting. And that's how I was trained. I was trained as a contract player.
So you're basically trained to give good reaction shots.
Well, I'll tell you very honestly, I consider myself a reactor. I know I'm an actor or an actress, but I really do. I'm best at reacting. I enjoy it. I listen and just respond, you know.
Sharon Gless, was your first starring gig Cagney and Lacey then?
No, I did a series with Robert Wagner and Nettie Albert at Universal called Switch. I did several series. They used to do miniseries, the novels, and I starred in a couple of those. And I played Carol Lombard in one of those. Universal did groom me, and they did it very, very wisely. Minnie James did the whole thing. And she very carefully picked my projects. So by the time the contract system was over, Barney Rosenzweig had been asking for me for a year for Cagney and Lacey, because I'd already starred in series. In fact, I fought with them because I wanted to be billed over the title, because I'd been billed over the title at my last series.
Well, you were also working with a major star, Tyne Daly.
Yes, it was a great treat working with Tyne. Tyne had actually never done a television series. Tyne was all theater experience. I had no theater experience, but I had a lot of television experience. So we fed each other. You know, we complimented each other very, very nicely.
Well, there was also the idea of creating, somewhere along the line, the fact that Christine had this backstory of alcoholism, too. Mm-hmm. You went along with that because it kind of changed things. It gave depth.
Thank you. I will sit here very immodestly. It's modestly, actually, because I did not write it. I just was lucky enough to play her. I think Christine Cagney was the most complicated, most interesting woman that's ever been written for television. I don't think anyone's ever topped it. As writers, you know, we have fabulous, wonderful actresses on television now. But I don't think any of them have been given the opportunity to play a role that's as complicated and wonderful as Christine Cagney.
Somewhere along the line, Sharon Gless, you became active in abortion rights and in the gay and lesbian community. How did that come about?
Well, I've been very active in fighting the overturn of Wade versus Roe. And my interest in that happened during my Cagney and Lacey days. I was not a feminist when I signed on for Cagney and Lacey. I didn't know a lot about it. I was raised with boys and just always fought for myself. And I wasn't aware. I was uneducated as to what was really going on with women outside my life. And I learned a lot during Cagney and Lacey. And that got me very hooked into I'm very passionate about not letting this be overturned, because I have friends. I'm old enough to remember people who had to go to Tijuana and who died because they were sick and treated bad, you know, in coat hangers. It's all true. All those stories are true. When Bush was in office, I tell you, he was trying to get it overturned. So anyway, but we're fighting. We're fighting. We're out here fighting. And for the gay movement, I did a series called Queer as Folk. As I say, I've learned so much from Cagney and Lacey about feminism. And I learned so much about the gay community and the the fun they have, and also the fights that they are fighting. And I got caught up in it. This industry I'm in has done so much for me because the world of academia escaped me. But I am very passionate about these things that I've learned as I played these roles.
Had you, when you went into Queer as Folk, your knowledge of the gay and lesbian community was not that strong at that particular time?
Well, I wasn't as educated as I am now. I mean,
right.
The old cliche, my best friends were gay, and it's true. I mean, I moved around in the gay community, and I've played and had fun and been a part of it, but that was all laughs. We started doing episodes on Queer as Folk that educated me, and I became very, very close to a lot of gay people and still am. And I just learned. And when I was asked if I'd come and fight because of the role I played, Debbie apparently was a powerful character, and I always said yes, and I still do.
Debbie had an interesting story arc toward the end of the series. When her brother dies, he dies after a fight, and they never reconcile, and she has to deal with that. I mean, it caught my eye as being very, very interesting thing for them to do, where your character had to deal with the closest person in her life dying after a fight where he curses her out.
Yes, and she says something horrible to him, too. I can't say on your show. Ron Cowan and Dan Lippman created that show. They would not let me cry when he died. He said, Sharon, do anything you want, but do not cry. And I said, okay, thank you. It gave me great liberty, you know, because you hear say, now she cries, you know, and you go, whoa. I said, okay, I know what to do. And for, God, a couple of months, 3 months or so, they never would let me. They wrote where I talk about it. I threw a party for him, a Christmas party he'd always wanted. And obviously, it was, you know, there's stuff underneath. I mean, I don't just do one level. But they finally wrote a scene in a kitchen with my homophobic homicide cop where they wrote the scene. They said, now you can finally let it out. Say your guilt. Say just. And they wrote it all. But what was hard was, not hard, it was brilliant. They just said, no, Sharon. No, this is not an ordinary show. And I said, actually, you're right. When you first hear that someone dies, you don't instantly cry. If you have guilt like she did, those words she said to him, and when they came to tell her in the diner that he was gone, just before they tell her, they said, I think it was her son, said, Mom, Uncle Vic, yeah? So what does he want? Wants his pots and pans back? I mean, it was just, you know, tell him to go buy his own that cheap. I mean, you know, he did terrible stuff that she'd say. No, it was about 2 weeks later something happened, and they finally started letting it set in where I'd drop a tray, and things started when you deny grief. They were very smart in how they dealt with that.
And since then, you've worked on several shows and been a regular on both Nip Tuck and Burn Notice.
Nip Tuck, I was a guest on.
Oh, you were a guest on.
I did 5 episodes for them, right.
But Burn Notice,
Burn Notice is mine, yeah.
Have they started filming the next season?
Well, season 4, we will start shooting at the end of February. Cable's weird. We do 16 episodes, and they show 8, and then they wait several months and show the second half of that season, you know, a few months later. So is this January? Hi, yeah. This month they're going to show the second half. And Tyne Daly is opening the show with me. She's going to be in the opening episode.
Well, it seems like old home week because Stephen Mack from Cagney and Lacey is with
Stephen
you
Mack
at on A Round-Heeled Woman.
He came up here to do this as a favor to me.
When you're working with somebody that you know pretty well, is it all that different, say, than working with someone you don't know at all, just in terms of the relationship on stage?
The most intimate scenes I have are with Stephen Mack's characters. There's one other scene I have that's not Stephen's that's intimate. But Stephen and I have done so many love scenes throughout our career. He was my lover on Cagney and Lacey. I did The Immigrants, a miniseries with him. But we've never been able to be as blatant as we are here on stage. It is like old home week. It's just having a dear friend who I'm comfortable with. Some of the stuff is it's sex. But with Stephen, he's such a gentleman, you know, and very respectful. And he choreographs our sex scenes.
Well, one question people often have is, doing a sex scene on stage or on film or on television and going into those kind of intimate places when you are partnered when you have your own life apart from the person, how easy or hard is it to do that, to maintain your focus?
That's a wonderful question, and I'm embarrassed to tell you that it was very easy. And my husband was sitting there watching. He was in the back of the theater watching the rehearsals. But he hired Stephen for Cagney and Lacey. It was very, very focused because it's serious. I did not have a hard time with it at all. I trusted myself into Stephen's hands, literally. It was quite blatant. And now they're cutting it back a little. So only those who were there that first preview got to see that. It's a wonderful question because normally we would say you were uncomfortable. I wasn't. Chris Smith is very respectful, very sensitive man. And Stephen and I have done this before. Never, as I say, like we were doing it on stage. But I was in the hands of very good men. Jane Juska was new at this. So I was playing Jane, and whatever he wanted me to do, I would do.
So if you felt uncomfortable, it was perfectly fine. It was part of the character.
Mm-hmm.
How about the very, very first time years ago when you had to do a sex scene? Do you remember that at all?
I think the first sex scene was with Stephen Mocht. That's funny. I think my first sex scene was, I've always had a husky voice.
Right.
And I had to say to him, the actual lines were, please be gentle, you're the first. But I had this husky voice, so I had to whisper it, so that no one's going to believe it with his husky voice. And it was a period piece. That took place in San Francisco, The Immigrants, the whole story. And we shot it in Eureka, that particular sex scene. And after I said, please be gentle, you're the first, he lowers himself on top of me. One of the crewmen was in the room with a piano. We didn't know that. And he was playing just to break the tension, you know, because I was nervous. It was my first intimate scene with someone.
And then you'd been acting for quite a while at that point.
I think maybe about 3 years.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And this was your first time.
Yes, I'd been doing really comedy things. That's how the Universal first saw me, was a light comedian. And then I went on to do many more novels where I did even more than that.
Well, what was your first theatrical film?
My very first?
Yeah.
Airport 75. I was a contract player, and all the contract players were put into Airport 75 as stewards or stewardesses. Oh. We were not given a speaking part. We were being paid for anyway. You know, we were under contract. They paid us whether we worked or not.
Was that the one with Gloria Swanson?
It was. It was. Absolutely, that's the one.
Did you get a chance to meet her?
I did. I didn't get a speaking part. No contract players were allowed to speak, but I was in first class. I was the first class stewardess. Oh, I spoke to her. She was a friend of my grandfather's.
Oh, that's right. She would have been because she was part of that Cecil B. DeMille crowd.
And I went and told her that I was Neil McCarthy's granddaughter, and she's very dramatic, and said, oh, my darling Neil, please, you must tell him I love him. Well, I didn't have the nerve to tell him he died. She was so dramatic, you know, that I just thought it would upset her too much. So anyway.
Well, in those days when you were finding yourself this young contract player dealing with famous people, how mm-hmm. long did it take you to get over the fact that you knew the faces of these people from television and everything, and that you could just kind of deal with them as colleagues?
I don't know if I ever got over it. I mean,
really?
I've always been so starstruck. I eventually got comfortable like with the James Garner. But when I first did I did two Rockford Files. It's James Garner, you know? And he was so kind to me. He knew I was nervous. And Robert Young. These are probably names your viewers don't even know. Robert Wagner. Eddie Albert. I mean, these were big names to me, and they still are. But I have to tell you, without exception, every one of those men that I just mentioned was so kind to me, taught me so much. I worked with Lillian Gish.
Really? Did you ever get a chance to talk to her about the silent era?
Only in a way that she said, you young people are so spoiled. She said, well, actually, she sort of talked like this, you know. But she said, you're so spoiled. She said, we used to, what you call, pull cable. And she said, we lifted the props. Now if you plug anything in, you get arrested, you know, by the unions. She said, we did everything.
What were you in with her?
I did a remake of a movie called Hobson's Choice. It was a British movie, and it was a television movie, and it was done at Universal, and I starred in it. And Miss Gish played my patron, the patroness to whom I went to get money for my shoe store. We had a very, very famous cinematographer shooting it named Isidore Mankowski. And Izzy could be very temperamental. He was beautiful cinematographer, but she had a temper. And Miss Gish would sit in for herself. She did not have a stand-in. So she would sit there. And she said, "Mr. Mankowski, I think if you move my key light 2 inches to my left, you might get what you're looking for." But we all looked over at Izzy thinking, "Oh, my God, he's going to blow." And he said, "Certainly, Miss Gish." And he goes and he moves the 2 inches, and he looks over at me. You can't see it because it's radio, but it's one of those, she's right. She was right. These silent screen stars, they knew. They knew where the light was. They knew. She was fascinating. I did do another movie. I did one with Michael Douglas.
Oh, right. Star Chamber.
And I had a bed scene with him. And he was a perfect gentleman, and I was petrified. He always made a point of coming in. He always pretended he was busy. He'd go off the set while they brought me in because I was so shy. I had a towel on. Over my towel, I had a bathrobe. So they'd take the bathrobe off of me. I'd slide under the sheet. They'd take the towel off of me, put the sheet over me, and then Michael would come in and pretend he'd been busy. He was such a very, very nice man.
Well, I notice at the Golden Globes, they have the bottom level is for all the movie stars, and in the back is for the TV stars.
I know. They always put us in the back by the kitchen. It's a great night, though. It's fun.
Sure.
Everybody gets so loaded. Well, they serve booze while the camera's going. I mean, I've been there many times.
Your first foray into stage was pretty late, 1993, I believe, Watch on the Rhine in the West End. Is that correct?
My first play. That's
yeah.
right.
And that must have been very, very scary, so finally moving into theater.
It was, because I'd always thought, well, when I do theater, I'll do same time next year. That's right up my alley. Well, no. I did one of the great tragedies, Lillian Hellman's Watch on the Rhine. But I was in very, very good hands. Eric Hill was the creative director. I went to do it with Elaine Stritch. Elaine called me up. She said, "I want you to play my kid." I said, "Elaine, I don't know dick about theater. You know, I'm a film actress." He said, "I'll teach you theater." So I said, "Okay." So I packed up my trunk and I went to land in Boston, and we went back there, back east. And she walked off the show. I just thought, "Oh my gosh, what am I going to do?" She's just walked off. I stayed. You know, Barney and Monique James, who was my manager by then, was like, "Get back on a plane and come back home." I said, "No, I committed to these people. I'm not leaving." And they brought in Kim Hunter. Kim Hunter came in and played my mother. And what a trip. I mean, for me, to be meeting, because living in Hollywood as a child, we had a projector and a screen in our house, and we'd have movies that ran. And to meet these people, I can't tell you. I had such respect for them and just consider it such an honor that I got to work with them. You know, it's very heady.
Sharon Gless, let's get back to Round Heel Woman. Okay, it had one preview, which ran for 2 hours, which was kind of a rehearsal in front of an audience,
right.
Not really a preview. And the playwright comes in, cuts a half hour, apparently, because that ran 2 hours, and now
right.
It's an hour and a half.
Well, it was supposed to be 90 minutes. It's just that particular production of it ran. That was their first attempt.
Right.
Yes, it ran 2 hours.
And now you say that before you get to the actual show opening, the press opening, now comes all the refinement in terms of the characters and the director working with the actors.
Yes.
Is that kind of like the most fun before it opens, then, that you get to experiment in those different ways?
I don't know. You mean the preview nights?
Yeah.
They frighten me.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't enjoy that first preview night. It just, I didn't feel I was ready, you know, and I don't like making mistakes in front of anybody. When you're a film actress, you say, "Cut! I want to redo that. Burn that film." It wasn't fun for me because I guess I'm sort of a perfectionist, and I wanted it to be the way I dreamed it would be. And it's becoming that now, but we had to get it on its feet. It's a very complicated show. The set is complicated. It's a big arena. We're starting previews tonight, and we'll still make mistakes. I understand that San Francisco loves to come to previews and watch people make mistakes while they're trying to get it together.
Well, I also noticed that the preview, they gave out cards asking people questions about the show. Did you see those cards?
No, but both our director and Jane Prowse, the British playwright who flew in, said they were overwhelmingly positive. You know, to me, who I don't want to screw up on stage, and I'm just going, really? She said, but Sharon, they can see past. They see past. They know what they're looking at.
I remember a few years ago I was chatting with Carol Channing. She made the comment that there was always out-of-town tryouts where there's one performance, and I don't know if this is true in the plays you've done, where suddenly you kind of look around and go, wow, now we've got it. Has that happened in the plays that you've done, where there's some one performance in the previews where you suddenly go,
yes,
we've got it?
Yes, I can't remember when that moment is, but when you're reminding me of it, yes, there is a time where you finally breathe. And you say, okay, I've got it. What's interesting is everybody apparently in San Francisco knows, no, it's not ready for opening, but everybody in San Francisco understands that. They come to watch you just rehearse. Well, in the West End, we had a letter perfect for previews. They were a paying audience. I'm very grateful for this sort of relaxed atmosphere here in San Francisco, but it frightens me because I don't like going in front of an audience until it is letter perfect. But apparently they're very gracious, very generous audience, and they like watching us sort of find our way.
Sharon Glass, after Round Heel Woman closes in San Francisco, then you go on to the next season of Burn Notice.
I do.
And after that, do you have anything in the works?
Well, I'm hoping what happens in San Francisco for this play will determine the fate of it. And Brian Eastman is flying in from London to see how it goes. He believes in it. If it goes well here, he will then attempt to take it on, to take it other cities and hopefully then on to the West End, which is my dream. I'm keeping hiatus open next season, hoping that I'm still doing Round-Heeled Woman.
You've been listening to an interview with Sharon Glass, who's in San Francisco doing Round-Heeled Woman, a play by Jane Prowse, based on the memoir by Jane Juska. And Burn Notice begins around now, but you've already filmed this season, and you're starting on the next one.
You know it's the highest-rated cable show in the nation?
Really?
Yeah. Beats out Showtime, beats out HBO. I know, we're all scratching our heads and said, all right. Highest-rated cable show in the nation.
I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.